From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson, and this is On Point. President Donald Trump capped off a norm-busting Republican convention with a sprawling speech that took aim at his Democratic opponent, former Vice President Joe Biden.
Joe Biden is not a savior of America's soul. He is the destroyer of America's jobs. And if given the chance, he will be the destroyer of American greatness.
The convention unfolded against a backdrop of protests across the country after the police shooting of Jacob Blake in Wisconsin. Here's Governor Tony Evers.
We've got 400 years of systemic racism in this country, and if we don't do something about it, we'll be repeating Kenosha in cities all across our country and our state.
And the Gulf Coast battered by Hurricane Laura. Governor John Bel Edwards of Louisiana.
We have thousands and thousands of our fellow citizens whose lives are upside down because their businesses and or their homes have been damaged.
It's an historic week in the news, and we have a great panel to guide us through it all. Paula Reed, CBS News White House correspondent. Welcome back, Paula.
Thank you so much, Jane. It's great to be with you.
Thank you. Mary Bruce, ABC News senior congressional correspondent. Mary, great to have you.
Thank you for having me. Hi, Jane.
Hi. And Jane Costin, senior politics reporter for Vox. Thank you for being here, Jane.
Thanks so much for having me, Jane.
So we'll start. President Trump officially accepted the Republican Party nomination for a second term on the South Lawn of the White House last night. Paula Reed, we'll begin with you. What did you hear in the president's speech?
Look, he used the People's House as a political prop like no other president has before. There were fireworks on the National Mall, of course, his grand entrance coming down the stairs of the White House. But in addition to the pomp and circumstance, what I heard was a continuation of the White House's mixed messages on the pandemic. While Americans have, of course, been told to socially distance and wear your masks, not go to big events, you saw this crowd of about 1,900 people smushed in, no one wearing their masks. And while the president did acknowledge the lives lost to COVID, he kind of cherry-picked some numbers to really help his case. In one instance, he said the U.S. has among the lowest case fatality rates, but of course, the U.S. has one of the highest fatality rates in the world based on population. Otherwise, the speech really sounded a lot like his campaign stump speech. A lot of his greatest hits and many falsehoods were shared during this made-for-TV event.
Well, there were many mixed messages on the coronavirus pandemic, for sure. There was a lot of talk about Joe Biden. Here is President Trump during his 70-minute speech going after his Democratic opponent.
Make no mistake, if you give power to Joe Biden, the radical left will defund police departments all across America. They will pass federal legislation to reduce law enforcement nationwide. They will make every city look like Democrat-run Portland, Oregon. No one will be safe in Biden's America.
No one will be safe in Biden's America. Mary Bruce, President Trump called Joe Biden a Trojan horse for socialism, said that this election would determine whether the American way of life was preserved or destroyed. What struck you about the president's remarks?
Well, we continue to see the president really lean into this law and order messaging, painting this incredibly dark picture of what will happen if Biden is elected, suggesting that America simply will not be safe. And first of all, let's do a quick fact check there. Joe Biden does not want to defund the police. Joe Biden has also come out and condemned violence in any of these protests across the country. But he also, of course, has come to the defense of peaceful protests. The president, again, used really a litany of false statements and mischaracterizations to go after Joe Biden. And he really did go after Joe Biden. We tallied it up. He mentioned Biden by name more than 41 times. Contrast that with last week, where Joe Biden didn't even mention President Trump by name at all in his address. And what was interesting, I think, especially, is how much Joe Biden was responding to this. You know, even though Joe Biden said he was going to lay low, yesterday we saw him really come out swinging. He was on the cables even before the president made his remarks, pushing back against this concept that the Trump campaign has been pushing, that Americans won't be safe in Joe Biden's America. Well, Joe Biden says, look, what you are seeing right now, all of the unrest across the country, everything that is happening, he says that is happening in Donald Trump's America. And Joe Biden was quick to say that you know, all of the crises, the way that this administration is responding to this, he says, is simply throwing gasoline on a fire and is pushing the Biden team, pushing the president, you know, instead of playing politics here, to actually try and take steps to address some of the urgent issues at hand.
You mentioned the law and order message, Mary, from President Trump. It was a theme this week. Here is Vice President Mike Pence using his speech on Wednesday night to tout law and order.
In the midst of this global pandemic, just as our nation had begun to recover, we've seen violence and chaos in the streets of our major cities. President Trump and I will always support the right of Americans to peaceful protest. But rioting and looting is not peaceful protest. Tearing down statues is not free speech. And those who do so will be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law.
Jane Costin, speak to this broader message this week at the Convention of Law and Order.
Well, it seemed to be kind of a confused message in my view, because at the same time that they're making this law and order pitch, they had a number of speakers who condemned Joe Biden's role in the 1994 crime bill, which was believed to be too tough and to put more specifically African-American men in prison. So it was a simultaneous, the law is too tough, but we need to get tougher message, which I think is a tough needle to thread. I also think it's challenging to make this message when you see that it's, you know, it's important to be very clear about what crime statistics look like right now. Violent crime is flat in comparison to the previous year, and reported property crime this year is actually down. One type of violent crime, murder, is up in large U.S. cities, but it's not just in Democratic-run cities. Murder is also up in Jacksonville and Miami, which are both cities with Republican mayors and a Republican governor, Ron DeSantis. So we don't actually know why crime is going up, and we don't have the statistics from rural areas and suburban areas, because that's not how crime statistics work. But I also think that the use of this law and order message as an incumbent seems to imply that, if you'll recall, in 2016, the 2016 Republican National Convention centered on this American carnage message, and only Donald Trump could fix it. Well, now, 4 years later, he's saying that Donald Trump hasn't fixed it, but Donald Trump can only fix it.
Well, the convention this week busted a lot of norms. And as Paula mentioned, it is somewhat unprecedented for the White House to essentially be converted to a set for a political convention. Throughout the week, the government was used, government property was used for political purposes. There were videos shot inside the White House, the president greeting frontline workers, pardoning inmates. He presided over a naturalization ceremony. Paula Reed, some people are invoking the Hatch Act right now, which stipulates that executive branch officials must not engage in political activities. Was the Hatch Act violated this week?
So the Hatch Act, which, as you said, it prevents federal officials from engaging in political activity, it's overseen by the Office of Special Counsel. Not that special counsel, not Robert Mueller, but a different government office. And since there were a lot of questions, they released a statement today, and they specifically said that this law does not apply to the president or the vice president. And they also said that the South Lawn and the Rose Garden, where the first lady had her speech, where the president had his speech last night, that those are two areas where, in fact, some employees can engage in political activities without running afoul of the Hatch Act. Now, given everything that's happened this week, I've spoken with many officials who have been in previous administrations and been responsible for enforcing the Hatch Act, and they disagree with this interpretation. But if this is the entity that is responsible for overseeing this, if ultimately any criminal behavior has to be handled by the Justice Department, and it would be up to the whoever had run afoul, their boss, President Trump, to enforce it, we're going to see what we've seen throughout the Trump administration, which is very little regard for the Hatch Act. There have been questions specifically about senior counsel to the president, Kellyanne Conway, other top officials running afoul of this law, and nothing has been done. So given what we've seen over the past 3.5 years and this statement from the Office of Special Counsel, it is unlikely that there will be any repercussions or really any litigation over whether this truly did violate the Hatch Act. But it will be a question for the next administration, whenever they come in, if they really want to return to of the norms, because you look at that set, it looks like a concert. It looks like Live Aid or something on the South Lawn. And even if this doesn't apply to the president and vice president, certainly it takes many, many administration officials to put on an event like this. And what I saw on Twitter when I posted video of the set is a lot of people were outraged. They were very disturbed to see the White House used in this way.
Well, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo broke with precedent this week, becoming the first top U.S. diplomat to participate in a political convention in modern history. He taped a speech in Jerusalem while on a taxpayer-funded trip as part of his duties as Secretary of State.
I'm speaking to you from beautiful Jerusalem, looking out over the old city. I have a big job. As Susan's husband and Nick's dad, Susan and Nick are more safe, and their freedom's more secure, because President Trump has put his America First vision into action. It may not have made him popular in every foreign capital, but it's worked.
Mary Bruce, did this cross the line between diplomacy and politics?
Well, certainly House Democrats think so. They are now investigating if Mike Pompeo violated federal law here. This is just another wildly sharp break with tradition. I mean, secretaries of state normally go out of their way to avoid partisan events. And here you had the nation's top diplomat delivering a political speech at a convention while on a diplomatic mission abroad. And it also violates his department's own policy not to engage in political activity to back a candidate. But it really goes to, you know, the point Paula was making, the Trump campaign essentially trying to use the trappings of the incumbency, the trappings of the White House to boost the reelection effort. And I just have to say, I mean, it is a surreal experience, I think, for all of us reporters this week to be standing there at the White House covering a political convention. You know, I was there on the South Lawn for the president's acceptance speech, and it was just surreal to see the South Lawn of the White House turned into essentially a packed convention floor. It is something we have never before seen in our nation's history. And it is why you have critics crying foul, saying that the president is blurring this line between the presidential and the political, between his administration and his campaign. And the president, you know, even at one point in his speech, sort of boasted about the fact that they were at the White House and at this grand location and, yeah, you know, saying, look, he won. This is his house, his home. And so he sees, you know, nothing wrong with using this in this way. But
we're talking about a busy week in the news. Mary Bruce, Paula Reed, Jane Costin. When we come back, the police shooting in Kenosha and the ensuing boycott in professional sports. There's much more to come in this busy week. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This episode is brought to you by ShipStation. If you run an e-commerce business, you know how much work it takes to produce something great while dealing with complicated shipping issues. That's why over 130,000 companies have turned to ShipStation, an innovative tool that allows you to focus less on shipping and more on building your brand. With ShipStation, you can manage orders, label printing, reporting, and customer service on one easy-to-use dashboard. You'll reduce warehouse costs with reliable enterprise solutions and save thousands on shipping costs with discounts up to 89% off. Plus, you can effortlessly import orders from everywhere you sell online. So, turn your shipping challenges into opportunities for growth. Go to ShipStation.com and use code POD to sign up for your free 60-day trial. That's ShipStation.com, code POD.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. We're talking about the week in the news with a fantastic panel today. Mary Bruce, senior congressional correspondent for ABC News, Paula Reed, White House correspondent for CBS News, and Jane Costin, senior political reporter for Vox. While the president making his case for a second term last night on the South Lawn of the White House against the backdrop of a pandemic, an economic downturn, racial unrest, and a hurricane thrown in there. Jane Costin, every year since 1856, the Republican Party has produced a platform articulating its priorities for the next president. This year, there was no new party platform. They used word for word the agenda from 2016. How come?
Well, I think that they made the case that they did so because of the pandemic and because getting together would be too challenging, though the Democratic National Committee was able to do so using the same thing that we're using right now, online mechanisms. But I think it's more indicative of the fact that for right now, as National Review put it, the campaign statement appears to suggest that the platform is Donald Trump himself. And I think it's partly because Donald Trump has become more of a mainline Republican than the Republican Party has become more like Donald Trump. If you recall, in 2016, there was a lot of concern from conservatives about Donald Trump, not just because he's Donald Trump who says ridiculous and racist things, but because he was not a conservative. But it turns out that voters didn't care because mainline conservatism in many ways is not very popular with voters. But now we're seeing a Donald Trump who's emphasizing tax cuts and the beautiful boaters and suburban housewives. And I think that the Republican Party is incredibly comfortable with that kind of messaging, even while populists are not. So I think that it's not so much that they no longer have a platform. It's that Donald Trump is their platform and Donald Trump and the Republican Party are one and the same.
Here is South Carolina Senator Tim Scott. He was among several speakers at the RNC bemoaning the, quote, cancel culture. He said in his speech on Monday that President Trump's agenda increases opportunity for people of color, including Black Americans.
We are always striving to be better. When we stumble, and we will, we pick ourselves back up and try again. We don't give in to cancel culture or the radical and factually baseless belief that things are worse today than in the 1860s or the 1960s.
Paula Reed, this convention went hard on the culture wars.
Yeah, and one note on cancel culture, it was just a few weeks ago that the president essentially called for canceling of Goodyear because they were not allowing their employees to wear MAGA hats or other political attire, but they were allowing people to wear Black Lives Matter attire and messages supporting some other causes. Of course, that potentially put jobs at risk in a swing state. So just have to put that out there when we talk about cancel culture. But one thing that was so notable in its absence last night was that the president did not mention Jacob Blake, because this most recent wave of fallout from police shootings that we've seen have been as a result of the police shooting of Mr. Blake. And I actually asked the president a few hours before the convention if he had seen the video of that shooting. I asked him three times. He would not engage. He would not answer the question. He actually ended the press availability. And it's so significant last night when the message is supposed to be about law and order. And there you heard folks speaking on his behalf about what it is to be Black in America, to not mention this individual, to not bring it back to the humanity and the call for better police use of force against all communities. It's a notable omission, and it's obviously intentional. And that is part of their message, it appears.
Mm. Mary Bruce, and we'll get to more on the shooting of Jacob Blake in just a moment, but to stay on this point for a minute, there seemed to be a young and diverse lineup in the convention. Several African Americans speaking about Trump's record on criminal justice reform and historically low unemployment rates in Black communities before the pandemic. There was Nikki Haley, a former ambassador to the United Nations, making the case for the GOP as a welcoming place for minorities. How did that message play, and who are they trying to reach?
Yet there was a very intentional effort by the Trump campaign throughout the convention to try and project that they are, you know, broadening beyond their base. So you did hear from a diverse group of voices. I was struck, especially in a lot of the pre-produced videos that would introduce some of the speakers and themes. You would see quite a diverse, you know, sector of Americans speaking out on behalf of the president, or just everyday Americans who say they've had connections with the president or how they've been impacted by his policies. But there really was sort of a split screen in some ways, especially on the first night of the RNC, where you had speakers like Tim Scott, like Nikki Haley, who were giving what felt like more traditional convention speeches, really trying to almost broaden the tent, right? But then you also had speakers like the president's son, like Kimberly Guilfoyle, coming out and really directing their comments just at the base, trying to rile them up. And it created a bit of a disjointed feel. So I'm not sure how successful the RNC was at trying to reach out. But the president, you know, politically, he has an issue here. He knows that, you know, he has to build upon his base. It's why it's called the base, right? You're supposed to build on it. Mm-hmm. And it has been a challenge for him when looking at the polls. So he is clearly trying to reach out to a broader and make a broader appeal. But to Paula's point, you know, especially on the issues of race, and given what we have seen, given the remarkable split screen just outside of the White House last night, where you had the president with this packed crowd on the South Lawn, and yet on the other side of the White House, we had hundreds of people protesting, demanding change, demanding racial justice. And the president in his speech, the vice president doing the same, acknowledging the unrest, but never addressing the root cause, never discussing the actual concerns that protesters are raising across this country. Mm.
Well, and there were a lot of women speaking at this convention, Jane. Top female aides, including Kayleigh McEnany, Kellyanne Conway, trying to soften the president's image with personal stories about, you know, his kindness toward them and support of women generally. Here's Kellyanne Conway in likely one of her last appearances working for the Trump administration.
A woman in a leadership role can still seem novel. Not so for President Trump. For decades, he has elevated women to senior positions in business and in government. He confides in and consults us, respects our opinions, and insists that we are on equal footing with the men.
And here's Kimberly Guilfoyle, a former Fox News host and senior fundraising official for the Trump campaign, as well as Donald Trump Jr.'s girlfriend. She gave her speech on Monday.
America, it's all on the line. President Trump believes in you. He emancipates and lifts you up to live your American dream. You are capable. You are qualified. You are powerful, and you have the ability to choose your life and determine your destiny.
Jane Costin, just a couple of the many women that we saw on stage this week. There is a huge gender gap in this campaign. Several polls showing a more than 20-point gap between Donald Trump and Joe Biden when it comes to gender. That's more than double the gender gap of previous nominees in past elections. Republicans trying to bridge that gap, trying to reach out to those women that President Trump has referred to as the suburban housewives, right, who may not share the president's political views but who don't like him, but may vote for him. Was it effective?
I don't know. I think it's very challenging in general, just to get a little bit meta here, that occasionally we're asked, you know, do you think that this is effective with a group of people who I am not a part of? I am not a suburban white female voter. But I do think it's interesting that so much of the language of how Donald Trump has spoken about at this convention is that we're supposed to ignore what he says and instead rely on the personal stories being told to him by either people who are related to him or work for him, which is essentially the argument that you've heard, you know, yeah, sure, my boyfriend's really annoying at parties, but he's very nice in person. And so I think a lot of this is an attempt to reach out to suburban women. But it's also worth noting that the suburbs are far more diverse than either Donald Trump or the Republican National Convention seems to understand. And Donald Trump's approval rating with Black women, for instance, in the state of Pennsylvania during the 2016 election was 1%. That is one, as in the number one. Mm. And I think it's worth mentioning that this is an appeal that is aimed at suburban women, but it's aimed at a very specific audience of suburban women. It's aimed at, in his view, affluent white suburban voters, the quote unquote soccer moms. Well, Black and Latino women also drive their kids to soccer practice and also might be interested in social justice issues and also might share a host of other identities that are far more complex and weren't recognized here. Mm-hmm. And I think it's worth noting that, you know, Kellyanne Conway is the same person who invented the Bowling Green Massacre and the term alternative facts. So it's interesting to see how much of this was a pitch to an audience, but it's an audience that only really exists in the imagination of the Republican National Convention.
Well, 10 weeks until the election, the debate season is next, and we will be watching. Thanks to you all for your commentary on this. Let's move on now to the protests that continue in Kenosha, Wisconsin, after Sunday's police shooting of Jacob Blake, who was left partially paralyzed after that shooting. A 17-year-old is charged with first-degree reckless homicide and use of a dangerous weapon after shooting and killing people during the protests that followed that shooting. Paula Reed, another shooting of an unarmed black man by police. What stands out to you in this case, Paula?
One of the big things that stood out to me just from my vantage point here at the White House is whether it was appropriate to have a big political celebration while you have these two other major events unfolding in the country. The first is a hurricane that was battering the Gulf. We know historically the GOP has been willing to cancel parts of the convention in the wake of that. And then you have the fallout from yet another police shooting. We asked the president if it was appropriate. He believed it was very appropriate to continue with effectively a political celebration. But when he was pressed further by reporters yesterday on what he thinks of some of the fallout of this, specifically, for example, the protests taken on by professional athletes, a peaceful protest, not playing their games, the president's reaction, it just didn't seem to meet the moment. In fact, when he was asked what he thought of that protest, he started to attack the NBA's ratings, saying that their ratings aren't very good because people are tired of the NBA. It's been interesting to watch what the president thinks is and is not acceptable protest. While he has endorsed waving or using the Confederate flag as someone's First Amendment right, when it comes to professional athletes either taking the knee or here canceling their games, he's come down pretty hard on them and often attacked typically their ratings and the league overall. It seemed a little bit tone deaf given how widespread these protests are and the fact that at the core of what people are asking for is equal justice under the law and the statistically supported argument that there are portions of this population, specifically black men and women, who are treated differently, often using more excessive force when it comes to police interactions than other people who live in this country, and why he does not want to engage on that conversation or on policies to address that is unclear.
Jane Costin, even after everything we've witnessed these last few months, the video of that 17-year-old white teenager walking down the street with a long gun after he'd shot and killed people during the protests following Jacob Blake's killing. It was stunning. What were your thoughts?
I have to be honest. I think that it really is indicative of the real challenge we face with police reform is not just the unequal use of police brutality between African Americans and white Americans and other people of color, because it's very true that white Americans have been shot and killed while unarmed by police. The case of Daniel Shaver, for example, the case of Maggie Brooks in 2019, who was shot and killed in Arlington when the officer was actually aiming for a dog. But I think that it is that unequal application of available law by agents of the state that is really the central concern here. Because what you saw here is that a person was shot in the back seven times while maybe doing something, while someone who is holding a long gun is walking towards police, and police seem to view him as one of their own. And this goes to a side issue, which is the long-standing relationship between quote-unquote vigilantes and police officers who view them with support. And I think that that gets to a separate concern about how we think about policing and the role of policing. And you've seen so much support for this shooter from some segments of the far right, though I should note that many conservatives have condemned his actions. But I do think that this the unequal application of law is the real concern here. It is saying that I wrote a piece about a couple of years ago talking about a jaywalking case in Florida in which a person was stopped by police for jaywalking, which they said was a felony. It isn't. And I made the point that if some people can break the law and survive and other people break the law and die, that law is not being applied equally. And I think that that's a really important point to make about why police reform is necessary, why ending qualified immunity for virtually all public employees is necessary. It's not necessarily just because of the racial imbalance here, but because if you aren't sure whether or not the law you're breaking is going to get you killed or get you applause, then that law doesn't make any sense.
Well, the outrage over the Jacob Blake shooting was a crossroads moment this week in professional sports, as Paula mentioned. An unprecedented boycott in the NBA, the Milwaukee Bucks refusing to play in their playoff game, and other NBA teams joined in. Then players from the WNBA, Major League Soccer, Major League Baseball joined in solidarity, refusing to play. Mary Bruce, this is clearly an unprecedented unity here with regard to the message they're trying to send.
Yeah, and it really is this tectonic shift, I think, in the world of sports, right? To see players from all four pro leagues walk off the court, walk off the field, demanding some kind of action is really remarkable. And it is unprecedented. I mean, we certainly have seen athletes at the forefront of demands for racial justice, really pushing this movement throughout, you know, our country's history. But what's different here is that they're not just protesting. They're not just, you know, raising concerns. But we have never seen players walk away from performing their duties as professional athletes in this way. And to hear so many make this really a personal position, I mean, to hear LeBron James come out and say that he feels so passionately about this, you know, not just as a prominent Black man in our country, but as a father, saying he has two small boys.
Yeah.
And he feels a need to make a change in this country for them.
And here's another passionate plea from Los Angeles Clippers coach Doc Rivers, answering questions on Tuesday night about the shooting of Jacob Blake.
We're the ones getting killed. We're the ones getting shot. We're the ones that we're denied to live in certain communities. We've been hung, we've been shot, and all you do is keep hearing about fear. It's amazing to me why we keep loving this country, and this country does not love us back.
Paula Reed, about 10 seconds here. Every time I hear that, I, you know, get chills. This Black Lives Matter message to the world was quite striking this week, Paula.
Incredibly striking. How can you not be moved by that? But here at the White House, the approach seems to be just pretend it's not happening.
Paula Reed, Mary Bruce, Jane Costin, we're discussing the week in the news. Up next, the coronavirus pandemic, reversals at the CDC and FDA this week, and Hurricane Laura pounds the Gulf Coast. There is more to come. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson. Well, on Monday, we're going to be talking about a way to regain normalcy in the pandemic by increasing the availability of rapid COVID-19 tests, even ones you can take at home. What questions do you have for our expert? How would at-home rapid testing impact your behavior, your decisions? What has your experience been with COVID testing so far? We'd love to hear your story at 617-353-0683. Today, we've been discussing a busy week in the news with a great panel. Jane Costin, senior political reporter for Vox, Paula Reed, White House correspondent for CBS News, and Mary Bruce, senior congressional reporter for ABC News. Well, let's turn to the Centers for Disease Control, which reversed its coronavirus testing guidelines this week. The CDC now says that people without symptoms do not need to be tested, even if they're in close contact with someone known to have the virus. Paula Reed, why the shift?
Well, what's so interesting about this shift is that it comes as the president's clearly his reelection chances have been diminished by the pandemic, and he has repeatedly called for less testing. Now, the White House insists that this was made based on the most recent research, that they've just come to revise their understanding. But these changes were made and discussed at a task force meeting on August 20th, where Dr. Anthony Fauci was not present. He said that he had previously read other revisions, but not this one, and he was not present when the task force discussed these. He says that his concern about this is that it sort of gives the impression that asymptomatic spread is not a risk, because these new revised testing guidelines essentially say if you've been exposed to someone who has it but you don't show symptoms, that you don't necessarily need to get a test. And he is not backing this. And there are a lot of concerns about whether the CDC, the FDA, a lot of these federal public health agencies are being used to help forward the president's political agenda and his political goals. But it's been really interesting trying to report this out this week, because every official you speak with has a different spin on exactly what happened.
Well, some public health experts said this week that the change in policy is a direct result of pressure from the White House and an attempt to hide infection rates as we move toward the election. Yesterday, CNN's Allison Camerota asked Vice President Pence's chief of staff, Mark Short, about this change in testing guidelines from the CDC. And here's how Short responded.
The guidance that was updated is because there continue to be backlogs in the system with the testing, particularly for people who are getting tested or asymptomatic.
Okay,
people,
so it's because of the backlog. So you're having to slow it down because it's backlog.
No, it's not a matter of slowing down, Allison. Over 800,000 tests are being conducted a day, more than any other country in the world, six times more than any other country in the world.
So, Mary Bruce, the White House says that the new guidelines are due to testing backlogs. This is smart policy, has nothing to do with politics. What are you hearing?
Well, there's just a lot of mixed messaging about this going on. I mean, just listening to Mark Short there, it's clear that they haven't quite figured out how to explain this decision. And of course, we did see the CDC director, Dr. Robert Redfield, try to walk this back a little bit after there was such fierce backlash to this decision. You know, now he says that all close contacts of confirmed or probable COVID patients may consider getting tested. But what is just so striking, I think, about all of this is the fact that while the president, you know, in his speech, his big acceptance speech, said that they are, or tried to project that they are following the best recommendations of science experts, you know, sources tell us that the people in the trenches were horrified by this decision because they fear it gives the impression that asymptomatic people cannot transmit the disease, which is simply not true. And because Anthony Fauci, the nation's top infectious disease expert, simply did not sign off on this. I think this is one of those instances where the White House may have, and it is very hard to get a clear answer on how this all worked out, but, you know, may have made this move without necessarily realizing how much backlash they were going to get, and now are clearly trying to spin this in a way that can be beneficial to them. But it is just, I think, something that really took off this week and frustrated a lot in the medical community, and also left a lot of Americans greatly confused about what steps they should be taking here. Mm.
Well, we have been warned for months that 40% of infections are asymptomatic and 50% of transmissions occur before symptoms show up. So, Jane Costin, I mean, I guess the question I have is the CDC is it's the basic function of our government. They've been apolitical always and now seem to be sort of getting caught in the politics of this moment. How do you see this, and what's the response from public health experts from your reporting?
I think it's first worth noting that while the CDC thinks of itself as being an apolitical body, this is not the first time that it has received a lot of political pressure. If you'll recall, in the late 1980s and early 1990s, the CDC underwent a significant amount of pressure from groups like ACT UP and other HIV activist groups because of a belief that it was slow walking attempts to challenge HIV AIDS. This is a challenge that is attempting... One of the challenges we're facing with coronavirus is that we are attempting to mesh public health guidelines onto public life. And so while public health guidelines might state that we should be maintaining social distancing and getting tested frequently, we're also, I think for many Americans, trying to get back to life as we miss it, life as we think it should be. And so I think that this divide here is the very strange line that public health officials are trying to walk. And so I think that you know, while the CDC has claimed that there was no political involvement in this decision, that there was no direction about what we needed to do, and that this was an evidence-based decision that was driven by scientists and physicians, it's worth noting again that Dr. Anthony Fauci was having surgery during this decision-making process.
Yes.
And I think that it also says that this is, we need to hear more about the scientific rationale for this decision. We need to hear about why this decision is being made and what it really means. We are seeing a spike in COVID cases in the Midwest. We're seeing spikes in Nebraska and Iowa. This disease has not gone away, no matter how much we all wish that we could stop Zooming from our living rooms. So I think it really is on the CDC to be leading out in front about this decision, especially because, as Donald Trump announced, speech, purportedly we're supposed to have a vaccine by the end of the year. Now, I take that with about a pound of salt, but I also think that if the CDC is seen as being increasingly politicized, that's going to challenge vaccine uptake across the board, especially with an administration that has been so wiggly on this very issue.
Paula, do you agree with that?
Absolutely. And I think what we have to remember is when the book is written or books will be written about COVID, this is not the CDC's finest moment. If we go back to the beginnings of this pandemic, they botched the rollout of those initial tests. They put a lot of barriers in place to really try to get the private sector on board. And throughout this response, the CDC has made decisions and done things that may not have been in the interest, the best interest of the American people. And when we have the benefit of hindsight to really look at their total response, There may be some significant repercussions for the CDC's reputation as a result of how they have handled COVID-19.
Also this week, the FDA, commissioner, Stephen Hahn, apologized for overstating the benefits of convalescent plasma to treat COVID-19. Scientists and medical experts have been pushing back on this, pushing back on these claims since President Trump announced on Sunday that the FDA would issue emergency authorization to use plasma treatments. Mary Bruce, President Trump has been hailing the decision to use the plasma treatments as a historic breakthrough. What's the significance then of this mea culpa from the FDA commissioner?
Well, I think the bigger picture here is that, again, you have the president touting and suggesting that there is a medical breakthrough essentially just around the corner that's going to help lead the nation out of this horrific pandemic and out of this crisis. And yet you have the medical community saying, whoa, not so fast. We have seen this before, as the president has touted other treatments. I'm thinking of the hydroxychloroquine incident. But it is just this remarkable push-pull that you continue to see between an administration that wants to come out and paint essentially a rosier picture versus the medical community that is trying to be very realistic about what the path forward here looks like. And again, you heard the president in his acceptance speech talking about plasma, talking about this potential treatment and giving what may be a false sense of hope to many Americans who are, you know, eager like the rest of us to see some kind of a return to normalcy. Mm.
Well, 180,000 Americans have now died from the coronavirus. Nearly 6 million have been infected. This week, 17 states saw a decline in new cases, which is good news. But the lagging indicator, of course, are the death trends. And 18 states report more deaths this week than a week ago. So, you know, Jane mentioned the spikes of COVID cases across the country. Yes, we've come down from the peak of the summer surge. Paula Reed, the question is, are we in a plateau or, you know, I mean, it's hard to know. But as we head into the fall and a possible second wave, a lot of people on edge.
Absolutely. And this is part of the issue with the feds sort of deferring to the states to all do their individual response. We don't have a central federal database where they collect all this information, where they can do contract tracing, where they can sort of monitor tests, get tests in their areas of surplus to areas that need them so that they can keep tabs and know this big outstanding question, where there'll be another wave. Will there be another wave going into the fall and into the winter? And this is not good news for President Trump and his campaign. Because as we've seen in the polling, the overwhelming majority of voters do not think he has handled this pandemic very well. And if we don't have any clear view on the trajectory of this pandemic, it's hard to really get any true economic rebound. We are seeing some good indicators. Obviously, the stock market is doing well, but that's different from the economy and unemployment. And for President Trump and his reelection pitch, that is not good news. But a lot of this is the product of this approach, this federalist approach that they've taken. to, instead of having the federal government do a top-down management style of this pandemic, they've largely deferred to the states. Mm.
Jane Costin, weigh in here. How do you see it?
Yeah, I think that it really is indicative, you know, as we've mentioned, that the polling that Trump has received on this has been very bad, no matter how much the Republican National Convention would have you believe that the coronavirus pandemic is in the past. And so I think that one of the real challenges we face here is that there was an idea that this was something that that would end, that there would be a distinct ending to this moment. That's not what we're seeing. And as schools start to open up, which I think that there's an entire separate show we could do on the fact that colleges are opening up, but elementary schools aren't, what it should probably, based on the science we have now, be the reverse. I think that you're going to see an increase in cases. And I think that that's, you know, while it's true that the majority of cases happen to people who are over 50, that is millions upon millions of Americans. And I think that when we have such a large population of baby boomers and, you know, people who are part of the greatest generation who are living with, attempting to survive and dying from coronavirus, I think that it's worth keeping in mind that this isn't going to go away.
Well, certainly more to come as we watch. We can't end this hour without talking about Hurricane Laura, because at the end of this busy week, it was a big, big news story. Hurricane Laura plowing through the Texas and Louisiana coastline. It made landfall as a Category 4 hurricane, 150-mile-per-hour winds. The destruction goes on for miles, entire towns underwater, nearly a million people without power. Paula Reed, this is happening, of course, in the middle of a pandemic, which complicates everything. How is the administration responding here?
Well, initially, the administration was criticized earlier this week because we didn't see the president. He wasn't out briefing about this. Usually, he would get in front of TV cameras. He would bring charts and graphs, one he famously modified with a Sharpie, to talk about the federal response. Now, under that criticism, yesterday, he opened a FEMA briefing to the press. I was there with him, and he sort of half listened to the officials as they went around the table. There were some slides that he looked at. They were obstructed. He asked a few questions. But for the most part, he has been willing to really focus more on the Republican National Convention than this hurricane. And as I said earlier, historically, the GOP has been willing actually to modify their convention schedule in the wake of these kind of catastrophic storms. Thankfully, this one was not as deadly as they thought it might be. But it is significant that when the president was asked, hey, is it appropriate to throw a big political celebration while folks on the Gulf are getting hammered? He said, yes, this is very appropriate. Mm.
Mary Bruce, this is the same area devastated by Hurricane Rita in 2005. This was a storm surge described as unsurvivable. Lots of folks hurting down there right now.
It is just horrific and heartbreaking to see the images coming in. So much destruction and so many people who, you know, have been hit before and not that long ago. And so to just, you know, talking with our team that has been down there riding out this storm and are now seeing, you know, this area try and think about how they may recover. This is going to take years and a lot of money. And it's going to need a lot of federal assistance to help get things back to a semblance of where they were before. You know, as always in these incidents, I'm struck immediately by the power of Americans' resilience. It is always remarkable to see neighbors helping neighbors and people coming together. But as you mentioned, the pandemic really complicates all of this. It is hard to think about wanting to go to what may be an overcrowded shelter yes. in this really remarkable time. But just, I think everyone's, you know, hearts go out to everyone who is suffering through this right now, because it is going to be a long road ahead.
Our thoughts are with those in the South. We are thinking of you. Jane Costin, end us here. A big gathering, a big march this weekend in Washington. What are you expecting?
So it's a massive gathering. It's the 2020 March on Washington. It was called Get Your Knee Off Our Necks. It's expected to gather about 50,000 people. It was announced by Reverend Al Sharpton, who has attracted some, I think, righteous controversy because of his use of instrumentalized anti-Semitism in the late 1980s and the early 1990s. But it was announced during the June funeral of George Floyd. And then as more protests have happened this week, it's really attracted a lot of attention. There are a ton of groups involved, and the relatives of those who have been killed by police, including the relatives of Breonna Taylor, who the officers responsible for her death have not yet been arrested, the family of Eric Garner, and the families of other people who have been killed by police are expected to attend. Other DC-based family members are also going to speak. There are still, obviously, coronavirus quarantine travel exceptions that are curtailing some of the numbers, but people who are in attendance, based on the photographs so far, they're vastly wearing masks, and there are temperature checks being had at the event. But it is a massive. No one is allowed actually to enter the area without a mask, and there's going to be 20 hand sanitizer stations. Yeah. This is representative of a massive movement, and it's we've come so far since 1963.
And we'll be watching a busy week and so much to talk about with a great analysis today. Paula Reed, CBS News. Thanks, Paula.
Thank you.
Mary Bruce, ABC News. Mary, thanks.
Thank you.
And Jane Costin from Vox News. Jane, thank you. And I want to give thanks to our production assistant, Bradley Noble. He's taking his talent to D.C., and we will miss him. Best of luck, Bradley. Have a good weekend. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point.